Hello, and welcome to this episode of Her Music Academia, the podcast. I'm your host, Lydia Bangura. Welcome to the show where I talk all about music. I talk about my own experiences in classical music as an opera singer. I'm also a music researcher. I'm currently conducting music research as a PhD student at the University of Michigan. And I have guests on the show to talk about what they do in music, not only classical music, but lots of different genres and lots of different ways of engaging with music. Whether you're a music performer or you're an educator, you're a producer, you're a composer, we are musically expansive on the show. Today, I'm so excited to welcome Tayo Omishore on the show. He's a musician who makes original rap music, and he also has a YouTube channel called Color Mind, where he makes these like leftist YouTube video essays and incorporates music making into it in a really fascinating way. We talk all about his musical upbringing and his influences. We chat about his music making process, and in particular, we get into one of his videos on his YouTube channel that he made in response to popular music theory YouTuber Adam Neely. Adam's video was about why we don't see quote unquote rap covers, or why rap songs aren't covered in the same way that other genres in popular music are covered by other artists. So we kind of break down why that might be and kind of discuss his video from our perspective as Black artists. We had so much fun chatting about it and hypothesizing around it. So much fun, in fact, that I'm actually going to split this episode into two episodes. So this is just going to be part one. Stay tuned for part two, which will be coming shortly. Without further ado, here's our conversation. All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of the podcast. Today, I'm so excited to introduce my guest. We're going to get into YouTube today, which I haven't really talked about this on this podcast because it's a music podcast, but I'm a big YouTube girly, so I have a bunch of faves and we're going to talk all about it. So today we have Tayo Omishore on the podcast today. Tayo, how are you?
Lydia, I told you my name was Toby.
Oh no.
We went through this before on Soundcheck. I cannot believe you have misnamed me. After my express, I'm kidding. Hi, Lydia. How are you doing?
You know what's funny is that I fully thought it was Tayo. Why would I think that? Before you even said it, you said, oh, Tayo. I said, oh my God, I was about to just say Tayo.
No, it's fine. Yes, my name is Tayo. Color Mind Ty, as some of the digital streets know me.
Yes. I'm sorry. Okay. You know, we're sipping and we're having a great time tonight. So, So yes, Tayo is a YouTuber. He's a musician. So we're going to talk to him all about his YouTube channel and his music today. So I always start off with talking about how I got introduced to the guest that's on the show that day. So what was the first video that I watched by you? Background for the listeners. Again, I'm big into YouTube. I don't really do a lot of watching movies and TV. I just have gravitated towards YouTube. And that happened around the time that I was in grad school, around the time I moved to Chicago. I don't know. I just started getting invested in, I watched a lot of makeup content. And then I somehow got into the leftist YouTube space and became fascinated.
It's an addiction. You know, it starts small and then it just slowly takes over every inch of your life until you're just in the deepest corners and you're like, Marx?
Truly. And then it was suddenly like, I'm radicalized and I don't know how this happened. So, you know, I remember first getting really into For Harriet, and then it was all kind of through there. I'm big into Jewelzy. I love Khadijah. I love FD, T Noir, all of those people. And so as I kind of navigated the leftist Black YouTube space, the cornbread space, I remember first seeing you in one of FD's videos.
I feel like it probably was the Desirability.
Yes.
Video,
yes.
Desirability.
Yes. Yeah.
In which, you know, FD just calls me out in front of 400,000 people, calling me a slam poet. He did not ask me that before that. He just assumed that I was, and I was very attacked.
We love it. So, listeners, I will link this video that we're referencing in the show notes. A really, really fascinating look into the way that we're talking about masculinity today, and features a lot of really great interviews with other people on YouTube and their own relationships to masculinity and desirability and love and sex and things like that. So just really fascinating video, and just, you know, it just gives me so much hope seeing men have these conversations, because the niggas that are in real life, LOL. That's all I'm gonna say about that.
They are well certainly not doing the reading material. They are not doing the reading before class. Not all of them.
But you know, that's all I'm gonna say about that. So it's just nice to see those conversations happening, and to get to participate in those conversations and comments and stuff. So then from there, I got really into your videos, started watching them, and as soon as I watched, I think it was that inflation video, or no, you know what it was the himbo video. Whoa.
Oh, thank you.
Daddy Kronk, yes. Whoa. So I remember watching that, and then as soon, you know, you get 10 minutes into the video, and then there's this like musical interlude, and I'm sitting there and I'm like, wait, what? And he's rapping, and I'm like, wait, huh? And I'm like, oh, this is original music. What is going on? And so instantly I was like, oh, whoever this person is, absolutely fantastic work, you know, blending
Thank
these
you.
Two mediums of storytelling. So, you know, the listeners know I'd be cold emailing people and just like, do you want to be on the show? And he said, yes, listeners, yay. So, yeah, so let's start off with talking a bit about you and your musical upbringing. So the music that you were listening to when you were growing up, where you're from, and the music that was happening in the place where you're from, if you're from a musical family, all of that stuff.
It's funny because I'm not from a musical family, but I did listen to a lot of music mm-hmm. by myself. I naturally like really, really liked music growing up. The first thing I ever shoplifted was a copy of Graduation from my public library to burn it and then return it.
Period. We're responsible.
Right, because I also spent a lot of time in the public library because my mom worked during the day. So I would like take, I'd be above my limit and like, I couldn't take out anymore, but my library would always get for something like the new urban CDs, like the day after they would come out.
Come
I think
on.
The way I probably like to think about it is that I grew up in Baltimore County, and I listened to a lot of 92Q jams, WEQR 92.3. And okay. like that was, because I was always in the car with my mom, where I always had like a radio on me. Mm-hmm. That was like the soundtrack of like a lot of my elementary through middle school, listening to Pharrell, Chris Brown, T-Pain, even like the throwbacks, because I was like the other place that I spent a lot of time at was the barbershop. So sure. Quest, Wu-Tang, like a very like hip-hop soul oriented vibe mm-hmm. in my outside life, where I spent time around a lot of Black people. And then in my home, because I'm a first generation Nigerian American, weirdly enough, like we didn't listen to a lot of music, but the music we listened to was Bob Marley. So I have like,
okay,
I know way too much about Bob Marley, but not enough about any other type of like, I think, music from that time.
Okay.
And so I feel like self-conscious about it, because I like, it's like a diaspora thing where it's like, I don't have connection to as much Black and soul music, but I have Bob Marley and Fela. And that's like basically was my childhood growing up, listening to reggae, Afro beats, and then listening to like a lot of rap, and then of course a lot of pop punk.
Oh,
I love me some pop punk.
Oh, come on,
some Panic, some
Fall Out Boy, Paramore,
right? Even like some deep cuts too. If I really want to date myself, like Boys Like Girls.
Come on,
like come on, like
shout out one time.
The audition, like let me stop. But you know, yeah, I grew up liking a lot of different types of music. I grew up going to an art school for middle and high school, but because I tend to go in creative things, but not do the creative thing actually, because at this time my parents wouldn't let me. So I went to a really big art school that had a Spanish program. So I tested into the Spanish program, and then I was a big part of the chorus. So then we would like compete. And then like I was working for like a really great core director that like, I still listen to this day. Shout out Mr. Christian. And then from there, I went to like the second biggest art school in Maryland besides Baltimore School for the Arts, Carver Center for Arts and Technology. Mm-hmm. But I did the business track. And then I doubled, basically, I did a double concentration in choral and business so that I could like be a part of chamber choir and like learn how to sing and stuff, but still learn accounting.
Wow. Okay, so this is fascinating because, so, you know, shout out to my parents one time, also not supportive of me being a musician. So I was a musician against their wishes. I did not double major in something sensible. I did my my undergraduate degree That's in cool, opera though. Performance, and then I did my master's also in opera performance. So I was big into classical music and started playing viola around the time I was 8 or 9. And so I had a big classical background and really got into singing when I got to college. So I switched to opera. So yeah, feel you on the African parents who were very much like, oh, we did not come to the US for you to be a musician. Like, what is
exactly
happening?
They were like, what is that? And like, I think like very much to like, I'm the oldest in my family. So very much, I too. Think to that dynamic, it makes you get inventive to say like, okay, how am I gonna like straddle this? And it makes you think, what I think is, has always been like kind of a privilege that I had. At least I had parents that were like, we really want to make sure that you are financially stable, or like you have the paperwork to be financially stable. And then on my side, I was like, but I'm dead inside. So I really want to do something else. So like to try, so I had a plan since I was like 12 to be like, man, okay, you know, I'm gonna figure out how to do music. And the backup plan is going to be being like working in business. At the time, like when I was 15 or 12 to 15, I was like, I'll be a businessman. Like, I just thought that was a position. Businessman. It's like basically what I thought my dad did. He wore a suit. He came in. We lived in a nice lower middle class neighborhood.
Yeah.
And like we had like nice little pool in the background, in the backyard. But I'm like, okay, this is nice. So I can do that. But then also somehow I'm going to be like the CEO of like a record label, or I was going to do something music and business related. Right. That was like my plan, or my coping mechanism, really. Right. Mm-hmm. And then over time, I was just like, no, I really like creating. And two, either due to me being an Aries or a Nigerian, I really like being told I'm good at what I do. And like, as I got more confident and more positive feedback on the stuff I made, I was like, nah, like, I don't think I just want to be like the president or just the accountant. Right. I think I want to also tell stories. I think I like telling stories.
So my mind goes to, as far as careers that kind of blend like business and music, did you ever think about doing like music production, music management, or anything like that? Does that appeal to you?
No, because I wanted to make money.
And that's on that. You heard it here first.
I wanted to do a thing where my parents knew I was going to make money. Mm. Because like, you know, now I know A&Rs. Now like I see people that manage, and I'm like, oh, huh, you know, like it is actually something that looks pretty enjoyable. But I know growing up, I was like, well, if plan B is to make sure that I make money, all right, I'm gonna do a regular job, or not even a regular job, a professional trades job that like I recognize you get a paycheck for. Okay. And like growing up, I was like, oh no, like it, like, you know, music managers, that seems too salesy, doesn't seem as stable as just being a business person.
Yeah. So, and also considering your background is in choral music, do you gravitate a lot towards like live performance?
I love live performance. Like when I was in college, that's actually when I got my first writing gig. I wrote for a magazine called Capital Sound. And it was a small like indie DC digital magazine that basically gave me the opportunity to go to free concerts or get free concerts tickets for like writing at the mid to indie venues. And that's where I got like, I have a strong love for live music because that, God, I'm about to get philosophical, but that is music, right? Like, I'm an audiophile. I really like, y'all can't see because it's an audio recording, but I'm wearing nice Audio Technica headphones right now.
Because
like,
he wants to hear all my mouth sounds.
The ASMR, you know, I need the texture. You know, I own a sound bar in my room when I shouldn't be able to afford that. So I like sound, but I also like, have you ever gone to like a Steve Lacy concert? and actually been there when the bass is like buzzing your soles of your feet. You know, like that's why he made the song, not like for me to listen to it like alone in my room, but it's for how it's supposed to sound in a room. And I know it sounds all like hippy dippy or whatever, but I think like because I spent so much time writing and being like thinking about concerts that way, I'm like, yeah, the concert, especially with the pandemic, I was really afraid that the concert was going to go away. Ultimately, I'm not that worried because I do feel like concerts are like a human necessity, but it definitely made me realize just how necessary live music is and how it truly is. You can tell when music is made for live music, and it makes all the difference.
Mm.
Or really, an artist is a live musician artist. That's actually what I'm saying.
Oh, sure. Yes.
Performance is important.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all that and sharing your experiences. Let's back up a little bit. And so can you talk about when you started getting interested in creating your own original music? So experimenting with freestyling or making beats, or like how that process developed?
So when I was in high school, I think I got my first ripped copy of of Fruity Loops off of someplace. Okay. And like, I was determined to be Soulja Boy.
Okay.
Not really. Actually, I probably was trying to be T-Pain or something like that. But
T-Pain. Like, that's even better.
I say this all the time, and not to sound like overly resentful or anything like that, but I started writing first. Like I started singing. I wasn't the best at singing, but I still liked singing. And like one thing about me, I'm hard-headed. So I was like, nah, I like singing. I'm gonna keep singing. Mm-hmm. But then where I grew up, people just wasn't trying to share beats or share how they made beats or share how they made songs. So like, unless you were already like in the sort of like five team group of niggas that were already trying to become rappers to make it out the hood.
Sure.
And so like over time, I just kind of like, all right, I don't really like the beats they're making. They're not trying to share them anyway. What if I just make my own stuff that I want to write over and just kind of figure it out on my own, just because I just had no other resources.
Yeah.
And then like over time, like, you know, I got like pretty decent at producing and like writing. And then I started rapping basically because I was like, the beats I was making, I was like, I got the hook, but I need a verse. I would give the verse to somebody else. I didn't like the verse. So I was like, okay, cool. I'll just write it myself.
Mm.
I had fun with that. That's probably the biggest thing with music. Like once I started it, I got ADD. I drop a bunch of hobbies all the time. And for some reason, I don't drop music. I keep coming back to it. I keep making stuff. And that addiction, if you can call it that, started when I was 14. And like, I probably dropped my first like mixtape in quotes, like on like Dat Piff or some shit. And told everybody in my business class, I was like, hey guys, like what's good? Clown the fuck out of me. Did say, I do remember this. They did say beat selection was good. I didn't make any of the beats. I didn't make most of the beats. That's when I was like ripping them off of YouTube or whatever. But they were like, the beats are solid. You sound like Gary Coleman, but the beats are solid.
Mm.
It basically was like almost like a secret passion that I would work on. Mm. And then every once in a while, because like I need feedback on what I'm doing to keep being interested in it, I'd be like, okay. And then over time, people just started to know me. It's like, oh yeah, Ty would be like, he'd be like singing. And I kind of just carried that over into college, which is when I started to take it like actually seriously.
Mm-hmm.
More so because, yeah, when you're in college, I met a lot more artistically minded people who were into the same things that I wanted to do.
Yes.
And that's when everything sort of exploded. I got to make movies that won awards. I got to write in places. I got to write for people and get published. And I started to be able to produce more artistic content for other people or get it shown in places. I was like, okay, yeah. I kind of just kept doing it because I think, and this is me being kind of raw, the way that I make art almost like necessitates that I have to put it out. Like it doesn't feel done until I get to show somebody it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Fascinating. I mean, so as somebody who I didn't really grow up with rap, I've always been a pop girly, and my parents only listened to West African music and gospel. So that was happening in my home. And then, of course, outside of the home, I was, you know, Beyonce, Rihanna, girl boss lady when I was growing up, girl groups, all of the Destiny's Child, Spice Girls, all of that stuff. So I just didn't really get into rap until, again, until I moved to Chicago. From context, I'm from Arizona. RIP. So moved out of Arizona, got to Chicago. That's where I did my master's. And that's when I was like, oh, black people. Oh, I'm black. Wait. So that's when I started listening to rap for the first time. So I definitely feel like I am coming to rap and hip hop and R&B from a bit of an outside perspective, just because it wasn't like a core part of my childhood. Of course, I had my pop punk phase too. Still one of the best concerts I've ever been to. Fall Out Boy, when they were touring with Paramore in 2014, slayed my whole life. I think about it weekly. I think it's so interesting whenever I hear about rappers and their songwriting process and the process of putting stuff together and the way that it sounds. It's just so different from the classical music space, obviously, especially because as the experience of a performer who's performing music by someone else, you know, by a classical music composer or something like that. We have one other rap episode of the podcast, and just hearing about, like, yeah, I just kind of threw shit together until it worked and kept doing it until people stopped clowning me and kept like, and just like, I can't imagine it. And because there's no standardized process, right, for how that stuff comes together. With opera, it's like, you know, you go to school for it, you major in it, you have a teacher, you do a study abroad program and get your name out there. And it's a bit more clear cut. Obviously, all careers in music are pretty volatile, so there's a lot of up and down and leeway. But music that lives outside of the academy, I'm just so fascinated with how it works and functions and lives, because I just don't have any experience. I'm like, I don't even know how I would get started in that. I need someone to, I need a class, I need to major, I need to, I'm just such a school.
You gotta hit that Lupe MIT class
honestly, and we talked about it. Lupe, get on the podcast, please. I love you.
Wait, so. But do you not feel that same sense of competition like when you were in school training to like be an opera singer, within like being, I guess, seen as competent by your classmates when you guys had to perform thesis?
Oh, certainly. I'm very competitive. Like, I'm a star. So yes.
That part.
So yes, I've always been pretty competitive. Even more so when I got into opera, because viola is way less competitive because it's just not as common as an instrument. So since I'm a soprano and we have so many sopranos, it definitely kick-started like, oh, I'm gonna eat y'all up, like, get ready.
Right. I feel like rap the same, you know, like, it's really? Like, it's not as standardized, but it's because, like, it's just more, you know, I hate using the word natural, but I mean, it's more I guess, like, humane, maybe more inherent to the human experience. I think about I was watching this video from a PBS, they have like a music YouTube show, and I can't remember the name of it right now. Soundfield, PBS Soundfield. And they were talking about, like, why does the Black church produce so many phenomenal vocal performers? Why is it that every belter started off singing worship songs in their local church when they were like 14 or when they were like 7?
Yes.
So it's the person who's leading the episode is this classically trained pianist, Nari Soul. And she's like, yeah, so like, what's going on there? And she's talking to the pastor, and she's just like, listen, if they trash, they're just not going to get invited next week. that's why, like, you perform for your friend for hundreds of your friends and family,
right,
every week,
all the time, yeah.
And like, because it's church, no one's gonna say you bombed, but like,
but you know, if you did,
there's gonna be some people that always get the solo, right? Yeah. And those people that always get the solo tend to be people that are who have through feedback,
right,
able to perform very, very well underneath their circumstances. And I think, like, yeah, I think that's true everywhere. When I was in chamber choir, when I'm fighting for first tenor, like, I'm like, it's because like, the only reason why I even knew I could fight for that was because I was consistently in the top three. And that wouldn't be like, that sounds so weird to say, like, it's just chamber choir. But it was because I was like, hey, I noticed it's like me and two other people that are being asked to, like, hey, can you guys learn this? And that does, I think, in a very natural way, make me say, like, okay, cool. That means I don't want to disappoint. I want to, like, express how well I can do this piece of music. And I think that same competitive edge that you and me are talking about is the same thing that makes successful rappers good, or successful writers in general good, like this desire to show how good you are at your craft. What's interesting about our field, right, is that it's art. So when we're saying how good we are at our craft, we're almost saying, like, how good are we at communicating our internal voice, our own desire, which is who else gets to do that?
That's fascinating, because, you know, people that say that Black people are like naturally born performers or whatever, and it's like, we just be in church. Like, church was such a huge part of my
we are just in a neutral sense in a we live in a performative culture, in which, like, you know, like we are allowed to perform, we are allowed to express, and therefore that means we also get a chance to curate our own expressions. Like, you just don't get that, so there are no social norms or things to like impress people with, because it's like you're supposed to be
Or the social norms are just different, the performance just looks different. But it's obviously so apparent in the way that we run the entertainment industry, obviously, in everything from sports to music to theater to dance. So now let's pivot to talking about YouTube and how you got started making YouTube videos. I have so many thoughts and questions.
So, when I get this question, I do like to date myself and say I technically probably have been trying to be a YouTuber for like over 10 years. Like, I started my first channel when I was like in seventh grade.
I was 12 or 13.
It's still up there too, somewhere.
Where?
Oh, I've been trying. I do not have access to the fucking email anymore.
Find that so link.
Listen, I mean, people are gonna type my name and see like four different channels. And part of me, before one of the channels actually worked, I was like, nah, I'll keep them all up. You know, people deserve this archive. Now that people have like seen my face and have opinions on me. Hey, FBI, we can work. If I can just get one thing scrubbed.
Oh, no.
Now, sports. Soft to a fault and too hard on myself. Hold a comfy atop my delts. I just tighten my belt. So I'm not worried about no nigga that just typing a text. Go to Ramsey, you can't speak to the chef. A drum break, nigga reflect. The backwood for the day, they de-stressing. Good head, never let me forget. It's the little things I try to protect. Plant a seed, pray it bloom into another moment. Yeah. This shit feel like touch football on a black tie. Dark skin bitches and then y'all smile. Like I'm him.
Yeah, I started YouTube because, maybe similar to you, as soon as we got a computer in our house and YouTube was a thing, we were watching a lot of YouTube, or I was watching a lot of YouTube downstairs or everybody was upstairs. That's the thing about art, right? I think like a lot of artists end up doing the thing they just like, because what is the greatest form of flattery if not like copying, or just trying to also do the same thing? And I feel that way about a lot of things, where it's like, yeah, I the things I make are basically things I enjoy. Like, what else would I make? I like the thing so much that I want to show my own understanding of it. But yeah, I tried a YouTube where I was singing for a little bit after Justin Bieber got hot. Then Beyonce did not call me, so we left that one. I
can't wait to see her, and you're gonna make your guest appearance on the Renaissance Store, and now featuring
I love it. I just kept trying to start channels whenever I like felt like, okay, yeah, I do want to talk. And, you know, not to be a hipster about it, but I'm realizing now, you know, I was making video essays before video essays was hot.
And you heard it here.
I was
first.
Making
breaking
stuff
news
about like white wealth versus like Black richness or something, like when I was in high school. So like 2014.
Not the political commentary.
No one saw that shit. I don't
already.
Even. Who knows what I said? I probably sound like a
listeners.
I probably sound like
that
a moderate
link.
But oh my god, my doxing is gonna be immaculate one day. But you know, the same thing would happen, right? Like I say, I drop a lot of hobbies, and I would be like work on it, and I would kind of enjoy what I did, but nobody saw it. Then music kind of took over, because once I got into college, I started performing a lot more. I started getting a lot more opportunities, you know, and that was just really good for my own self-image, I guess, because I was like, okay, cool, like I was finally getting to play out the can you be a musician route. And like that was doing So Far Sounds, that was performing Kennedy Center, that was like people writing about me. And I was like, okay, cool. I guess, you know, to be honest with you, YouTube was still all in the back of my mind. And I was like, I'm going to be the most backwards person ever. And I can't wait to be a Grammy Award winning musician who then leaves to start a YouTube channel.
No.
With everything I wanted. Cause that's like my idea of like good financial freedom money. I've always saw YouTube. I've always seen YouTube that way. I'm like, say whatever you want about how fucked up Google is or whatever, but YouTube is the only platform where the promise is pretty decent. Mm-hmm. You make a good catalog of your thoughts, you make a good catalog of your ideas, and they will just keep paying you for it. They would just keep running ads on it, and you can just keep getting money from that. Or you can keep getting sponsors from it and become like part of a movement that like feels more autonomous, feels like you're actually working for what you're getting paid to do. I'm sort of getting off of my point, because at this time, which is around like 2018 to 2020, I'm musician Tayo. And then the panty hit, you know, there weren't a whole bunch of gigs, obviously.
Right.
I was still working on music, but I also just got, since we were at home all the time, I got really into video essays again. Like I got really into like YouTube seriously, because really during that 2018, 2020 time, I wasn't like watching YouTube like that. I was like keeping up with, you know, what my friends were watching on streaming. I was still on it. Like for me, it's like my longest standing relationship with anything has been Vlogbrother videos. Like I still
love
watch
them. Wow. Still, love Vlogbrothers, like, Dear Hank and John.
Exactly,
big fan.
Like, have not missed an episode of that, or I've watched every episode of that channel since I've been in 10th grade. But that would be the only thing. Like that was YouTube. I'm like, okay, I go watch Hank and John. You know, I might go watch like some Crash Course stuff, like only educational things. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, I think, as often comes up in this conversation when we talk about YouTube essays, especially Black people, shout out Khadijah Mbowe.
Also an opera singer, love.
Right, exactly. Because I think like it was their video on like Black masculinity. It's like they brought up a Will to Change, and it was about that they were the first femme presenting creator I ever saw say, you know what, the boys have it rough, and here's exactly what I mean. Not too rough, but here's what they're dealing with.
Right.
And I was like, okay, I want to hear more. Because like that's also the like shitty thing about being a man is like you hear it, and like to be honest, I was finding things about myself out for the first time. I was like, you know what? Yeah, that does suck. I do hate that. That's how I have to relate to other men.
Yeah,
I didn't know that was the thing we could opt out of.
Mm-hmm.
And like from there, I was like, man, Khadijah pointed me towards FD, and from there, I was like, nah, like I wanna contribute to this. I enjoy the conversation being had. And at first, like the first like 20 episodes of Color Mind, which is, I realize now, the YouTube channel that I run, I don't know if I mentioned that.
Links in the show notes, everybody.
I was gonna try to do the thing where I was gonna try to force comment response videos back, because that's how old I am. I remember when YouTube used to have video responses like embedded, and I love those things because I was really into like BookTube and shit, so like people would be like talking through them. And I'm like, okay, cool. So like one of the first videos that I made was a response to Khadijah's video. I don't even think I did like numbers or anything like that, but I just enjoyed being a part of the mix. I felt like renewed by seeing all of these like particularly dark skin creators like me talking like I did, thinking about the same things that I did. And that's around like 2020, 2021. And I'm like just making videos. Nobody's really watching them, but like I'm having fun. And I had this idea in my head. I'm like, you know, that standard 100 videos. You don't think about anything. You just make 100 videos and you don't care if anybody sees them. Because by the time you get to 100, you should be better than you were at zero. But eventually I met like some of the creators who liked what I was doing, like horizontally. Shout out to Victory the Creator, because I think I commented like a thoughtful response on his video, and that he did like one on mine, and we just started talking. He was like also a Nigerian first gen, and we were making similar content, and he ended up being the person that ended up connecting me to a wider pool of Black creatives that showed me like, oh, well, we out here. Because I don't know if you also felt this experience, like when you, especially when you discovered, even when you discovered people like Cat Black, T-Noir, Kim Foster, it's like, whoa, I didn't even know this was here.
Yeah.
Because you watch so many other white faces and you're like, man, I guess like we just don't actually make YouTube videos. I guess like Black people just think it's clownery. And we're like, no, they're actually out here, and we all want to do something. So from there, I think once I got that backing, and this is like after the Adam Neely video, after the ADHD video, is probably when I meet this group of people. And then, you know, I make a video about himbos where I talk for like 55 minutes about strong, hunky men who make me proud to be a nicer man.
Yum.
And
yes.
Then like,
and I over ate it 50, up.
50,000 people saw it. And I was like, okay, cool. And then since then, it's kind of been cool. Like, I'm really appreciative of people noticing the work and being like, bro, I was thinking about this, but like not thinking about it that way. But I appreciate you thinking about it the way that you did.
Yes.
Because I enjoyed listening to your thoughts. Because I personally think that's my dream.
Yes.
Like, for somebody to listen.
Okay, so this is so fantastic because I, you know, I do a lot of research, so I'm, you know, getting ready to start my dissertation work in a year. Yikes. Thoughts and prayers. And I do a lot of research on Black people in the classical music space because it was a similar thing for me, right? Obviously, again, growing up in Arizona, split between moving back and forth between Denver and Phoenix. And so in the Southwest, I'm in classical music. I'm in this really white art form and am very much the only Black person in a lot of the spaces that I was, you know, doing music in. And that same phenomenon of like, I guess Black people just don't do this. Like, I guess I'm just the only one. I don't really know what, you know, what's going on here or how I can go about feeling more comfortable in this space. And then something happens where you discover, oh no, there are many, many people that do this and you have to do a lot of work to find them. But once you do, it's like, oh, you know, it right. kind of opened the floodgates for me. So I do a lot of research on Black people in classical music during the 20th century, particularly in Chicago, during like the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. And so I do a lot of research on Black women in that space, especially, and the way that they were collaborating together, right? It's so fascinating to look back on their manuscripts and papers and interviews and the way that they were all performing together, writing music for each other, premiering each other's works. And that could have been because they maybe might not have gotten their music performed any other way, but it's so right. important, like, the ways in which those ecosystems work. And as soon as you get sucked into it, you only need to know the one person and then they introduce you to everybody and suddenly it's this big artistic family that are all doing this great work together.
Yeah. I was listening on NPR the other day. I think it might have been the Smithsonian, but don't quote me on this. They got a collection of Black classical records mm-hmm. from the 30s that had only been printed like once by some very small Black, I don't know what you call it, like publishing corp.
Sure.
That specifically was like, because there's actually so many in history Black classical musicians, because it's a genre like any other one.
Exactly.
Of course, they gravitate towards it, but they weren't being allowed or they didn't have the resources to put it down and on wax.
Yeah.
So like the fact that really a very wealthy Black man had to go force this collection to happen, mm-hmm. like back then he was like, okay, I'm gonna get my money and I'm gonna build a studio just to get in the greatest mm-hmm. voices of that time. And I was listening to it, and I'm like, wow, thank God we got this archived, because we easily could have like lost that because no one at the time cared, not to like switch both geography and time periods, but I just saw Chevalier and I am on a kick.
Yes.
That nigga Chevalier. I've been telling everybody who will listen, because I when you tell start us. Learning about the world, right? After a while, you start getting jaded to being like, okay, no wonder I didn't know that thing. Or, oh, I guess that would have happened. And you start getting less surprised. Mm-hmm. Learning that he exists in history, just finding out about him now.
Right.
Truly astounded me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because I ended up doing, like, I ended up doing a super deep 2 a.m. dive after I saw like the trailer for the movie. And I was like, you telling me there was a Black classical virtuosic composer violinist who was better than Mozart, even though it was called the Black Mozart, who Mozart literally stole his runs. Mm. He literally slept with the richest white women in Paris. Mm. And yet he was still so cool. He was still such a rock star that during the French Revolution, they were like, I know you're rich, but like, just get on out of here, because they're like, they're not going to do that to him. That this person nuanced being, it was because Napoleon, after he got power, he burned a lot of old compositions, but like the suppression of his legacy
yeah.
happening when you connected to that feeling that you were talking about, like, I guess Black people just don't do classical music.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, if you don't have that story, that makes a whole bunch of sense. I do end up feeling sad about that, because it's not even like, I don't know that it's going to happen. It's like, I don't know where to expect it next. Mm. Like, what if I found out that like, actually Black people have actually been crushing it in motocross sports since the beginning, and I just
literally never knew, we're obviously such a foundational part of all of American history, right? There's not American history that we can truly be erased from, and so as much as white supremacy tries, obviously, and so, you know, those things are just waiting to be discovered. I think all the time about how the Metropolitan Opera just did its first opera by a black composer in 2021.
Really?
And it's not like black people didn't apply.
Yeah.
It's not like black people, and it's not like we don't have black, you know, opera from the 20th century that was sent in all the time. It's not like this black person just happened to be the most exceptional black person who's come throughout the Met's over 100 year history. It's that they finally decided, oh yeah, this is the black story that we want to tell. And it's all the way in 2021. So, like, you know,
and you black... should be happy about it.
Exactly. And you should just be happy to be in the space. And it's like, there are black composers, black librettists, black poets, black, like, we've occupied all artistic spaces since the beginning, and it just takes work to go back and find them and put a face and a name to those nameless people. So that's why I feel so passionate about my research and, you know, the way that my dissertation is developing, and just feel like it's really important not only, right, to name the people who are nameless in these spaces where we just don't associate black people with classical music, or black people with this art form, black people with this gender expression, black people with this, like, they just don't coincide. They do. We just have to find those historical examples, and it gives us the freedom to really access those expressions in our bodies now. And then furthermore, now here's where we have to get to the Adam Neely video. Now, because not only do we have the issue suppression of black people in these different art forms and seeing, you know, all types of expressions of blackness, we also have black art forms that then, when they are brought into standardized spaces, formal spaces, because we also tend to not associate black people with academia, because there's such a huge lack of black people in academia. It's something like 1-2% of tenured professors are black women. Insane. So then we get white people talking about black music now. Because, you know, I know my field specifically in music theory is 1% black. The Society for Music Theory is 1% black. Nationwide, we have about 1,200 members. So we're talking like a dozen nationwide.
It's crazy.
It's embarrassing. And so, you know, so then that means, you know, does black music being brought into the academies, when we're talking about, again, stereotypical kind of black art forms, the art forms that we associate with being black the most, such as jazz, blues, hip hop, rap, and R&B, even though, again, all genres are black. All genres are like based in black music, but, you know, those genres. So then when they're kind of brought into the academy and into the music research space, so because there's such a lack of black people in the space in general, then we get a lot of white scholars that do research on black music, and then that has its own issues. I'm not going to say that it's always problematic or a blanket statement that white people should never do it, but it is very complicated and very nuanced. And so then we get a video like Adam Neely. So let's talk about this video and kind of what you thought when you first came across it. So Adam Neely, for the listeners who aren't familiar with Adam Neely's name, I'll put the link to the video that we're referencing in the show notes. He's a music theory YouTuber, so makes a lot of videos on music in pop culture and kind of analyzes them and has some really interesting stuff. So he's probably one of the bigger ones. I think he has over 1 million followers. And there's also like 12 Tone. I think he has like 500,000 or 600,000 subscribers. So that, you know, they're in that kind of pop culture music space where they break down like kind of the details of music. And so he makes this video about rap and about
why there aren't any rap covers, right?
Yes.
Yeah, basically. So done to the track of like the Pimp a Butterfly or something too. Like the entire track, he's like building up like Kendrick's All Right or something. I totally forgot what it was. It was the most Caucasity thing that you ever seen. But I love Adam Neely. I love Adam Neely.
Adam, come on the show. We love you.
You're right. This is actually such a good topic to kind of talk about. If like, depending on how nitty gritty we want to go, or like what we want to do with the conversation. like, yeah, like Adam Neely wants to ask, like, you know, why? And it's a very common sense question. I think, honestly, you ask more if you're white, honestly. Why is it that, like, I have three different versions of my favorite Eagles song by my favorite guitarist, but, like, I can't even rap karaoke. Like, rap karaoke is still a foreign concept to most people now, and certainly was during, like, some people call it the golden age of Southern rap.
I'm gonna eat it up.
Exactly, right? And once again, pop rap ends up filling that space for a lot of people. And once again, what can you do covers of? You can we've seen a bunch of indie covers of plenty of pop rap
songs, right? Yes.
So, like, there's something about rap that seems like it doesn't jive with being replicated.
Yes.
And, like, sure, this sounds like a common sense question, like, duh, because he's rapping, and, like, why would you rap what another guy rapped? But you've kind of asked a much interesting question, where it's like, what value do we actually see when we replicate music?
In the imitation.
We go all the way down, where it's like what is music for? But if we don't gotta go all the way down there, where we could just say, like, yeah, what are we doing when we appropriate music from other artists? Like, what are we doing when we pay homage to them like that?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the video is just like, you know, kind of as a white person, he opens up saying, like, I know I don't know the most about this. And I remember pausing it being like,
but we're still gonna make the video.
But there's like 10 more minutes left.
Yeah.
And then the
first specialist that he brings on, who's throughout most of the video, is also white. So I was like, wait, what's happening?
Now, that's a whole bigger thing, right? Because that's Dr. Ethan Klein. He has a PhD in, like, music theory or whatever. You know, nice dude by all accounts. Like, I've read his work. And, like, he was one of the people who reached out to me after the video to be like, I really enjoy this analysis. It goes back to your issue about the representation of academia. Of course, it feels off to me that this white guy is being asked as the expert on how, like, on any sort of opinion on why this Black American art is the way that it is.
Mm-hmm.
It is uncomfortable because of the optics that I feel like you could have gone to anyone else before that.
Mm.
But then, like, on the other side, you counter and said, like, well, his lower third says his PhD was in studying Black American music or jazz.
Right.
And you're like, well, you know, I guess he did do his due diligence. And you, like, you know, I think normal people would just, like, well, I'm gonna just listen to him talk then. And you're still just gonna discount what he said because of what he looks like. You accept the bias. But it does make you think, well, why don't we have
Black experts in Black music?
Right. And not only in Black music, but, like, speaking about these topics, or, like, being, being
platformed in Black music research.
Their research being platformed about what they're thinking about, the questions of what we think is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I also understand that, like, it's even awkward for me because I don't know where I stand on it yet. I'm still chunking myself through the MIT Lupe class, like that, just that introductory lecture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once I get what I'm asking for, which is like, well, yeah, I wonder what it would be like to actually analyze what rap does.
Right.
I'm like, huh, it does feel like we're trying to explain water to a fish.
That part.
You know, it's like, you're explaining stuff and I'm like, yeah, that's how rap works, but, like, don't nobody think about it like that?
Yes.
And, like, what is the point of this analysis if nobody actually thinks about it like that? That's the big battle about music theory. Even I knew that in my, like, adjacent scuffles with music major nerds, where it's like, you know, what is the point of theory? You can, if you just enjoy kind of physics, honestly, or, like, math, music theory is great because you can just do all this crazy shit and be Jacob Collier. But ultimately, all jazz is the 2-5-1, and jazz isn't even the 2-5-1.
Right.
Jazz is the sound of the 2-5-1, which, like, is so distinct that, like, we created a thing so we could talk about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Right? The music is what's first. We're always trying to explain why music does that and work backwards, not, oh, if we put the scale numbers correctly, we should get happiness. And that's what a lot of, like, outside-in analysis of, like, rap music or Black music feels like.
Right.
It's a lot of, like, trying to fit it within a European or Western music canon.
Absolutely.
That doesn't give any sort of credence or space to maybe more emotional, maybe more sociological ways that like Black music developed the way that it did.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's like, again, to your point, as far as like, what is music theory for? Who is it for? So if we are going to talk a big game, as academia loves to pretend that it's really invested in DEI work and stuff like that, and we want to be proactive about bringing more Black music into the academy, for who? Right? Like, what is the purpose? Mm. Right? So like, if we're going to be invested in doing this research, for who? Like, again, my research, it's maybe a bit more straightforward because it is classical music. And so it already, it doesn't feel like it doesn't belong in the space. It feels like it's been excluded from this space purposefully. And so it's only getting kind of its rightful place. But even then, so it's like, Black music lives and thrives and survives outside of the academy. It always has. And so kind of to reverse engineer it and to bring it into the academy, especially art forms that kind of resist that standardization, such as jazz and such as blues and hip hop and R&B, what are we really doing by bringing it into academia and into research, into the classroom? Like, who is it for? I know that certainly, especially when you bring it into like music curriculum, like students like to hear it, right? They love to see syllabi that is more diverse and has more genres and styles of music because it replicates what music looks like in their actual lives. Like, a lot of the students that I teach are not just classical musicians, but they have, mm-hmm. this is kind of the issue with, you know, obviously standardized teaching in general, is that you have to make one curriculum work for a bunch of different types of students and a bunch of different ways that they're going to use the material that you're learning. So I have performance students, I have music education students, I have music production students who are interested in audio and engineering. I have, you know, so they're all coming to the same music theory classroom to learn Western classical music theory to do what? All sorts of things. And so hopefully they can get a nugget of it that's interesting, even if it's them disagreeing, even if it's just for the purpose of getting them to expand their mind about like, wait, I don't actually like the way that she taught that. And why, you know, even just to get their critical thinking skills kind of going, especially because I teach first years. So, you know, yeah, I just feel like, what is the purpose of doing this research? Obviously,
and I think there can be like satisfactory answers to that, that like still enable published works to exist. Mm-hmm. Right. I think like the answer to that, the most practical answer to that, that like you could be sure is the right answer, is what Black studiers of Black music want to study, what people would like to know about their own culture.
Yes.
Right. Like from there, you'd be like, oh, that's a pretty solid reason to want to study something.
Yes.
But like, then other than that, right, like I'm pro music theory in the camp of I enjoy the language of music theory, or I don't enjoy it, but I enjoy the utility of the language of music theory.
Yeah.
Like, it is nice. Before I learned the circle of fifths, like, I did not know what all those white keys were doing there.
Right.
Like, but the moment I understood, or really like what happened, right? Some person observed the patterns of music of tone and said, hey, I think you can basically follow this circle and like, you're going to be kind of on the right track. You're going to be hearing kind of the music that you need to be hearing in your head.
Right.
Right. That's important.
Mm-hmm.
Some person more radical than me could say like, throw the circle of fifths away. Like, cause like we didn't need it. Right. Like we were going to make that C chord regardless. We were going to sing in a three-part harmony regardless. Mm-hmm. Like the original music wasn't made up on music theory or on the circle. It was like, no, they just literally showed where your hand needs to go and we intuited what the pitch needed to be.
Yeah.
That's what staff music comes from, right? Mm-hmm. It's funny because Adam Neely, Austin McConnell, all those like pop music analyzers, mm-hmm. they kind of do the research that I think is the coolest part of using music theory. Mm-hmm. They're like taking what I hear and telling me, hey, you know how you like that sound? It's because it's a six chord.
Right.
And
it's because called it this. After, yeah.
Right. Like, so that like when you're hearing, you're not like, bro, like, you know that like green sound that be happening like in slide.
Not the green.
You know, you don't gotta say like crazy shit like that. You can be like, bro, that progression was hard. Mm. And the issue, if I can like make it racial for a second, I think like sort of, I liked your example of having all these different people who are gonna need music theory in different and varying ways, having to be taught the same sort of canonized Western system. And like, and then they sort of also then get admonished when they try to like break out of it or question, yes, like, why do we have to do it?
Yes.
It's very similar if we look at music theory as a language to like the same fear that we have of Gen Z, sorry, I mean Gen X, sorry, I mean baby boomers, of developing AAV and like starting not speaking the right grammar anymore. And like having a reinforcement of like, we need to make sure everything fits, like everything can be explained using our system, and you need to think using our system because everything's gonna fall apart otherwise. And that's been the pushback lately, right? Looking at the way that East Asian scales work, looking at the way that their music theory works, because it breaks our system, but like
their system's older than ours.
right, and like that music is hard, so it's explaining something, it's teaching us about how to control music.
Mm-hmm.
I get very passionate about that because I'm like, that's like, I think even little things like that, like the way that people are habituated to think about music theory, or just everything is just four chords, limits
right
how we're supposed to be experiencing,
yes,
how we can think about music, because like all this is descriptive, not prescriptive. That's what every teacher tells you, right? Like these are to describe the crazy shit you just did. Is not for you to use and put into a formula to get out something,
right?
And if we thought more that way, it wouldn't make as much sense to gatekeep. It wouldn't make as much sense to try to exclude things because we're just trying to capture all of sound, like every melodic quality. To go back to Chevalier very, very quickly. I do think about the fact that like when you listen to his suites or crap, he ended up inventing this like new style of performance,
mm-hmm,
like a symphonique, like a symphonique or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They are extremely catchy. Like even compared to Mozart, definitely in contrast to Debussy with like his very long phrases that are like very ambient. Mm-hmm. Chevalier has like, I'm gonna put it in a regular nigga way, you could sample his shit on trap beats. Like even then, even in the 17th century, the sensibilities of particularly the thing that I always catch is his ability to start a new musical idea every two bars.
Yeah.
Like he was very, very good at that. Like people are like, play number four, play number three. You know, you gotta have like really, really catchy tunes to make people make a whole bunch of powdered white stuffy people like wanna listen to your shit. But like Chevalier was really, really good at it. And I feel like that's because he was so percussive.
Yeah.
Even though he wasn't even raised around black people like that. Like here's where I'm getting about the racial part. What he understood was that he needed to be excellent.
Yes.
He needed to perform the music in a way that constantly kept their attention because, or else he was out.
Mm.
He didn't have a safety net the way that white composers would have had. And he knew that. And I think that's what makes a lot of white historians uncomfortable touching black music history, because a lot of our performances have to be informed by the circumstances that we made the music.
Yes.
And it goes back, yes, right? And it goes back
and to- you have to have the political, social understanding in order to do that sort of analysis well. Absolutely. All right, and that is going to do it for this episode of the podcast. Thank you so much to Tayo Omishore for being on the show. Again, it gets even better, folks. Stay tuned for part two. If you have any thoughts, questions, feedback for me, if you want to get in touch with me about the show, suggest some music for the show or something I should read for the show, check out for the show, please send me an email at hermusicacademia@gmail.com. If you want to be on the show yourself, please get in touch with me. Go ahead and go to my website, hermusicacademia.com, fill out the contact form there, tell me what you do in music. I would love to hear about it. Until next time, thanks for listening.